we reach the pit and announces, I want to get a tattoo. From behind us, Will asks, A tattoo of what? I don't know. Al laughs. I just want to feel like I've actually left the old faction. Stop crying about it. When we don't respond, he adds, I know you've heard me. Yeah, learn to quiet down, will you? Christina pokes Al's thick arm. I think you're right. We're half in, half out right now. If we want all the way in, we should look the part. She gives me a look. No, I will not cut my hair, I say. Or dye it a strange color. Or pierce my face. How about your belly button? She says. Or your nipple, Will says with a snort. I groan. Now that training is done for the day, we can do whatever we want until it's time to sleep. The idea makes me feel almost giddy, although that might be from fatigue. The pit is swarming with people. Christina announces that she and I will meet Al and Will at the tattoo parlor, and drags me toward the clothing place. We stumble up the path, climbing higher above the pit floor, scattering stones with our shoes. What is wrong with my clothes? I say. I'm not wearing gray anymore. They're ugly and gigantic, she sighs. Will you just let me help you? If you don't like what I put you in, you never have to wear it again, I promise. 10 minutes later, I stand in front of a mirror, in the clothing place, wearing a knee-length black dress. The skirt isn't full, but it isn't stuck to my thighs either, unlike the first one she picked out, which I refused. Goosebumps appear on my bare arms. She slips the tie from my hair and I shake it out of its braid so it hangs wavy over my shoulders. Then she holds up a black pencil. Eyeliner, she says. You aren't going to be able to make me pretty, you know. I close my eyes and hold still. She runs the tip of the pencil along the line of my eyelashes. I imagine standing before my family in these clothes, and my stomach twists like I might be sick. Who cares about pretty? I'm going for noticeable. I open my eyes, and for the first time, stare openly at my own reflection. My heart rate picks up as I do, like I am breaking the rules and will be scolded for it. It will be difficult to break the habits of thinking abnegation instilled in me, like tugging a single thread from a complex work of embroidery. But I will find new habits, new thoughts, new rules. I will become something else. My eyes were blue before, but a dull grayish blue. The eyeliner makes them piercing. With my hair framing my face, my features look softer and fuller. I am not pretty. My eyes are too big and my nose is too long. But I can see that Christina is right. My face is noticeable. Looking at myself now isn't like seeing myself for the first time. It's like seeing someone else for the first time. Beatrice was a girl I saw in stolen moments at the mirror, who kept quiet at the dinner table. This is someone whose eyes claim mine and don't release me. This is Triss. See? She says, you're striking. Under the circumstances, it's the best compliment she could have given me. I smile at her in the mirror. You like it? She says. Yeah, I nod. I look like a different person. She laughs. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I look at myself head on again. For the first time, the idea of leaving my abnegation identity behind doesn't make me nervous. It gives me hope. A good thing. I shake my head. Sorry, I've just never been allowed to stare at my reflection for this long. Really? Christina shakes her head. Abnegation is a strange faction, I have to tell you. Let's go watch Al get tattooed, I say. Despite the fact that I have left my old faction behind, I don't want to criticize it yet. At home, my mother and I picked up nearly identical stacks of clothing every 6 months or so. It's easy to allocate resources when everyone gets the same thing, but everything is more varied at the Dauntless compound. Every Dauntless gets a certain amount of points to spend per month, and the dress costs one of them. Christina and I race down the narrow path to the tattoo place. When we get there, Al is sitting in the chair already, and a small, narrow man with more ink than bare skin is drawing a spider on his arm. Will and Christina flip through books of pictures, elbowing each other when they find a good one. When they sit next to each other, I notice how opposite they are. Christina dark and lean, Will pale and solid, but alike in their easy smiles. I wander around the room, looking at the artwork on the walls. These days, the only artists are in Amity. Abnegation sees art as impractical, and its appreciation as time that could be spent serving others. So though I have seen works of art in textbooks, I have never been in a decorated room before. It makes the air feel close and warm, and I could get lost here for hours without noticing. I skim the wall with my fingertips. A picture of a hawk on one wall reminds me of Tori's tattoo. Beneath it is a sketch of a bird in flight. "It's a raven," a voice behind me says. "Pretty, right?" I turn to see Tori standing there. I feel like I am back in the aptitude test room, with the mirrors all around me and the wires connected to my forehead. I didn't expect to see her again. "Well, hello there," she smiles. "Never thought I would see you again. Beatrice, is it?" "Triss, actually," I say. "Do you work here?" "I do. I just took a break to administer the tests. Most of the time I'm here." She taps her chin. "I recognize that name. You were the first jumper, weren't you?" "Yes, I was." "Well done." "Thanks." I touch the sketch of the bird. "Listen, I need to talk to you about..." I glance over at Will and Christina. I can't corner Tori now. They'll ask questions. "Something. Sometime." "I am not sure that would be wise," she says quietly. "I helped you as much as I could, and now you will have to go it alone." I purse my lips. She has answers. I know she does. If she won't give them to me now, I will have to find a way to make her tell me some other time. "Want a tattoo?" she says. The bird sketch holds my attention. I never intended to get pierced or tattooed when I came here. I know that if I do, it will place another wedge between me and my family that I can never remove. And if my life here continues as it has been, it may soon be the least of the wedges between us. But I understand now what Tori said about her tattoo representing a fear she overcame. A reminder of where she was, as well as a reminder of where she is now. Maybe there is a way to honor my old life as I embrace my new one. "Yes," I say. "3 of these flying birds." I touch my collarbone, marking the path of their flight toward my heart. 1 for each member of the family I left behind. Chapter 9. "Since there are an odd number of you, one of you won't be fighting today," says 4, stepping away from the board in the training room. He gives me a look. The space next to my name is blank. The knot in my stomach unravels. A reprieve. "This isn't good," says Christina, nudging me with her elbow. Her elbow prods one of my sore muscles. I have more sore muscles than not sore muscles this morning. And I wince. "Ow." "Sorry," she says. "But look, I'm up against the tank." Christina and I sat together at breakfast, and earlier she shielded me from the rest of the dormitory as I changed. I haven't had a friend like her before. Susan was better friends with Caleb than with me, and Robert only went where Susan went. I guess I haven't really had a friend, period. It's impossible to have real friendship when no one feels like they can accept help or even talk about themselves. That won't happen here. I already know more about Christina than I ever knew about Susan, and it's only been 2 days. "The tank?" I find Christina's name on the board. Written next to it is Molly. "Yeah, Peter's slightly more feminine-looking minion," she says, nodding toward the cluster of people on the other side of the room. Molly is tall like Christina, but that's where the similarities end. She has broad shoulders, bronze skin, and a bulbous nose. "Those 3, Christina points at Peter, Drew, and Molly in turn. Have been inseparable since they crawled out of the womb, practically. I hate them. Will and Al stand across from each other in the arena. They put their hands up by their faces to protect themselves, as Four taught us, and shuffle in a circle around each other. Al is half a foot taller than Will, and twice as broad. As I stare at him, I realize that even his facial features are big. Big nose, big lips, big eyes. This fight won't last long. I glance at Peter and his friends. Drew is shorter than both Peter and Molly, but he's built like a boulder, and his shoulders are always hunched. His hair is orange-red, the color of an old carrot. "What's wrong with them?" I say. "Peter is pure evil. When we were kids, he would pick fights with people from other factions, and then when an adult came to break it up, he'd cry and make up some story about how the other kids started it. And of course, they believed him, because we were candor, and we couldn't lie. Ha ha." Christina wrinkles her nose and adds, "Drew is just his sidekick. I doubt he has an independent thought in his brain. And Molly? She's the kind of person who fries ants with a magnifying glass just to watch them flail around." In the arena, Al punches Will hard in the jaw. I wince. Across the room, Eric smirks at Al and turns one of the rings in his eyebrow. Will stumbles to the side, one hand pressed to his face, and blocks Al's next punch with his free hand. Judging by his grimace, blocking the punch is as painful as a blow would have been. Al is slow, but powerful. Peter, Drew, and Molly cast furtive looks in our direction, and then pull their heads together, whispering. "I think they know we're talking about them," I say. "So? They already know I hate them." "They do? How?" Christina fakes a smile at them and waves. I look down, my cheeks warm. I shouldn't be gossiping anyway. Gossiping is self-indulgent. Will hooks a foot around one of Al's legs and yanks back, knocking Al to the ground. Al scrambles to his feet. "Because I've told them," she says, through the gritted teeth of her smile. Her teeth are straight on top and crooked on the bottom. She looks at me. We try to be pretty honest about our feelings in candor. Plenty of people have told me that they don't like me, and plenty of people haven't. Who cares? "We just weren't supposed to hurt people," I say. "I like to think I'm helping them by hating them," she says. "I'm reminding them that they aren't God's gift to humankind." I laugh a little at that, and focus on the arena again. Will and Al face each other for a few more seconds, more hesitant than they were before. Will flicks his pale hair from his eyes. They glance at Four like they're waiting for him to call the fight off, but he stands with his arms folded, giving no response. A few feet away from him, Eric checks his watch. After a few seconds of circling, Eric shouts, "Do you think this is a leisure activity? Should we break for nap time? Fight each other!" "But..." Al straightens, letting his hands down, and says, "Is it scored or something? When does the fight end?" "It ends when one of you is unable to continue," says Eric. "According to Dauntless rules," Four says, "one of you could also concede." Eric narrows his eyes at Four. "According to the old rules," he says. "In the new rules, no one concedes."
"A brave man acknowledges the strength of others," Four replies.
"A brave man never surrenders." Four and Eric stare at each other for a few seconds. I feel like I am looking at two different kinds of Dauntless. The honorable kind, and the ruthless kind. But even I know that in this room, it's Eric, the youngest leader of the Dauntless, who has the authority. Beads of sweat dot Al's forehead. He wipes them with the back of his hand. "This is ridiculous," Al says, shaking his head. "What's the point of beating him up? We're in the same faction."
"Oh, you think it's going to be that easy?" Will asks, grinning. "Go on. Try to hit me, slowpoke."
Will puts his hands up again. I see determination in Will's eyes that wasn't there before. Does he really believe he can win? One hard shot to the head and Al will knock him out cold. That is, if he can actually hit Will. Al tries a punch, and Will ducks,
the back of his neck shining with sweat. He dodges another punch, slipping around Al and kicking him hard in the back. Al lurches forward and turns. When I was younger, I read a book about grizzly bears. There was a picture of one standing on its hind legs with its paws outstretched, roaring. That is how Al looks now. He charges at Will, grabbing his arm so he can't slip away, and punches him hard in the jaw. I watch the light leave Will's eyes, which are pale green, like celery. They roll back into his head, and all the tension falls from his body. He slips from Al's grasp, dead weight, and crumples to the floor. Cold rushes down my back and fills my chest. Al's eyes widen, and he crouches next to Will, tapping his cheek with one hand. The room falls silent as we wait for Will to respond. For a few seconds he doesn't, just lies on the ground with an arm bent beneath him. Then he blinks, clearly dazed. "Get him up," Eric says. He stares with greedy eyes at Will's fallen body, like the sight is a meal and he hasn't eaten in weeks. The curl of his lip is cruel. Four turns to the chalkboard and circles Al's name. Victory.
"Next up, Molly and Christina," shouts Eric.
Al pulls Will's arm across his shoulders and drags him out of the arena. Christina cracks her knuckles. I would wish her luck, but I don't know what good that would do. Christina isn't weak, but she's much narrower than Molly. Hopefully her height will help her. Across the room, Four supports Will from the waist and leads him out. Al stands for a moment by the door, watching them go. Four leaving makes me nervous. Leaving us with Eric is like hiring a babysitter who spends his time sharpening knives. Christina tucks her hair behind her ears. It is chin-length, black, and pinned back with silver clips. She cracks another knuckle. She looks nervous, and no wonder. Who wouldn't be nervous after watching Will collapse like a rag doll? If conflict in Dauntless ends with only one person standing, I'm unsure of what this part of initiation will do to me. Will I be Al, standing over a man's body, knowing I'm the one who put him on the ground? Or will I be Will, lying in a helpless heap? And is it selfish of me to crave victory, or is it brave? I wipe my sweaty palms on my pants. I snap to attention when Christina kicks Molly in the side. Molly gasps and grits her teeth like she's about to growl through them. A lock of stringy black hair falls across her face, but she doesn't brush it away. Al stands next to me, but I'm too focused on the new fight to look at him, or congratulate him on winning, assuming that's what he wants. I am not sure. Molly smirks at Christina, and without warning dives, hands outstretched at Christina's midsection. She hits her hard, knocking her down and pins her to the ground. Christina thrashes, but Molly is heavy and doesn't budge. She punches, and Christina moves her head out of the way, but Molly just punches again and again, until her fist hits Christina's jaw, her nose, her mouth. Without thinking, I grab Al's arm and squeeze it as tightly as I can. I just need something to hold on to. Blood runs down the side of Christina's face and splatters on the ground next to her cheek. This is the first time I've ever prayed for someone to fall unconscious. But she doesn't. Christina screams and drags one of her arms free. She punches Molly in the ear, knocking her off balance and wriggles free. She comes to her knees holding her face with one hand. The blood streaming from her nose is thick and dark, and covers her fingers in seconds. She screams again and crawls away from Molly. I can tell by the heaving of her shoulders that she's sobbing, but I can barely hear her over the throbbing in my ears. Please go unconscious. Molly kicks Christina's side, sending her sprawling on her back. Al frees his hand and pulls me tight to his side. I clench my teeth to keep from crying out. I had no sympathy for Al the first night, but I am not cruel yet. The sight of Christina clutching her rib cage makes me want to stand between her and Molly. Stop! Wails Christina as Molly pulls her foot back to kick again. She holds out a hand. Stop! She coughs. I'm done. Molly smiles and I sigh with relief. Al sighs too, his rib cage lifting and falling against my shoulder. Eric walks toward the center of the arena, his movement slow, and stands over Christina with his arms folded. He says quietly, I'm sorry.
What did you say? You're done? Christina pushes herself to her knees. When she takes her hand from the ground, it leaves a red handprint behind. She pinches her nose to stop the bleeding and nods.
Get up, he says.
If he had yelled, I might not have felt like everything inside my stomach was about to come out of it. If he had yelled, I would have known that the yelling was the worst he planned to do. But his voice is quiet, and his words precise. He grabs Christina's arm, yanks her to her feet, and drags her out the door.
Follow me, he says to the rest of us. And we do.
I feel the roar of the river in my chest. We stand near the railing. The pit is almost empty. It is the middle of the afternoon, though it feels like it's been night for days. If there were people around, I doubt any of them would help Christina. We are with Eric for one thing, and for another, the Dauntless have different rules. Rules that brutality does not violate. Eric shoves Christina against the railing.
Climb over it, he says.
What? She says it like she expects him to relent, but her wide eyes and ashen face suggest otherwise. Eric will not back down.
Climb over the railing, says Eric again, pronouncing each word slowly. If you can hang over the chasm for 5 minutes, I will forget your cowardice. If you can't, I will not allow you to continue initiation.
The railing is narrow and made of metal. The spray from the river coats it, making it slippery and cold. Even if Christina is brave enough to hang from the railing for 5 minutes, she may not be able to hold on. Either she decides to be factionless, or she risks death. When I close my eyes, I imagine her falling onto the jagged rocks below and shudder.
Fine, she says, her voice shaking.
She is tall enough to swing her leg over the railing. Her foot shakes. She puts her toe on the ledge as she lifts her other leg over. Facing us, she wipes her hands on her pants and holds on to the railing so hard her knuckles turn white. Then she takes one foot off the ledge and the other. I see her face between the bars of the barrier, determined, her lips pressed together. Next to me, Al sets his watch. For the first minute and a half, Christina is fine. Her hands stay firm around the railing, and her arms don't shake. I start to think she might make it, and show Eric how foolish she was to doubt her. But then the river hits the wall, and white water sprays against Christina's back. Her face strikes the barrier, and she cries out. Her hands slip so she's just holding on by her fingertips. She tries to get a better grip, but now her hands are wet. If I help her, Eric would make my fate the same as hers. Will I let her fall to her death? Or will I resign myself to being factionless? What's worse, to be idle while someone dies, or to be exiled and empty-handed? My parents would have no problem answering that question. But I am not my parents. As far as I know, Christina hasn't cried since we got here. But now her face crumples, and she lets out a sob that is louder than the river. Another wave hits the wall and the spray coats her body. One of the droplets hits my cheek. Her hands slip again, and this time, one of them falls from the railing, so she's hanging by 4 fingertips.
Come on, Christina, says Al, his low voice surprisingly loud.
She looks at him. He claps.
Come on, grab it again. You can do it. Grab it.
Would I even be strong enough to hold on to her? Would it be worth my effort to try to help her, if I know I'm too weak to do any good? I know what those questions are. Excuses. Human reason can excuse any evil. That is why it's so important that we don't rely on it. My father's words.
Christina swings her arm, fumbling for the railing. No one else cheers her on. But Al brings his big hands together and shouts, his eyes holding hers.
I wish I could. I wish I could move, but I just stare at her and wonder how long I have been this disgustingly selfish.
I stare at Al's watch. 4 minutes have passed. He elbows me hard in the shoulder.
Come on, I say. My voice is a whisper. I clear my throat.
1 minute left, I say louder this time.
Christina's other hand finds the railing again. Her arms shake so hard I wonder if the earth is quaking beneath me, jiggling my vision, and I just didn't notice.
Come on, Christina, Al and I say, and as our voices join, I believe I might be strong enough to help her.
I will help her. If she slips again, I will.
Another wave of water splashes against Christina's back, and she shrieks as both her hands slip off the railing. A scream launches from my mouth. It sounds like it belongs to someone else. But she doesn't fall. She grabs the bars of the barrier. Her fingers slide down the metal until I can't see her head anymore. They are all I see.
Al's watch reads 500.
5 minutes are up, he says, almost spitting the words at Eric.
Eric checks his own watch, taking his time, tilting his wrist all while my stomach twists and I can't breathe. When I blink, I see Rita's sister on the pavement below the train tracks, limbs bent at strange angles. I see Rita screaming and sobbing. I see myself turning away.
Fine, Eric says. You can come up, Christina.
Al walks toward the railing.
No, Eric says. She has to do it on her own.
No, she doesn't, Al growls.
She did what you said. She's not a coward. She did what you said.
Eric doesn't respond. Al reaches over the railing, and he's so tall that he can reach Christina's wrist. She grabs his forearm. Al pulls her up, his face red with frustration, and I run forward to help. I'm too short to do much good, as I suspected, but I grip Christina under the shoulder once she's high enough, and Al and I haul her over the barrier. She drops to the ground, her face still blood-smeared from the fight, her back soaking wet, her body quivering. I kneel next to her. Her eyes lift to mine, then shift to Al, and we all catch our breath together.
Chapter 10 That night, I dream that Christina hangs from the railing again, by her toes this time, and someone shouts that only someone who is divergent can help her. So I run forward to pull her up, but someone shoves me over the edge, and I wake before I hit the rocks. Sweat-soaked and shaky from the dream, I walk to the girls' bathroom to shower and change. When I come back, the word stiff is spray-painted across my mattress in red. The word is written smaller along the bed frame, and again on my pillow. I look around, my heart pounding with anger. Peter stands behind me, whistling as he fluffs his pillow. It's hard to believe I could hate someone who looks so kind. His eyebrows turn upward naturally, and he has a wide, white smile.
Nice decorations, he says.
Did I do something to you that I'm unaware of? I demand. I grab the corner of a sheet and yank it away from the mattress. I don't know if you've noticed, but we are in the same faction now.
I don't know what you're referring to, he says lightly.
Then he glances at me.
And you and I will never be in the same faction.
I shake my head as I remove my pillowcase from the pillow.
Don't get angry.
He wants to get a rise out of me. He won't. But every time he fluffs his pillow, I think about punching him in the gut. Al walks in, and I don't even have to ask him to help me. He just walks over and strips bedding with me. I will have to scrub the bed frame later. Al carries the stack of sheets to the trash can, and together we walk toward the training room.
Ignore him, Al says. He's an idiot. If you don't get angry, he'll stop eventually.
Yeah, I touch my cheeks. They are still warm with an angry blush. I try to distract myself.
Did you talk to Will?
I ask quietly.
After, you know.
Yeah, he's fine. He isn't angry. Al sighs.
Now I'll always be remembered as the first guy who knocks someone out cold.
There are worse ways to be remembered.
At least they won't antagonize you.
There are better ways, too.
He nudges me with his elbow, smiling.
First jumper?
Maybe I was the first jumper, but I suspect that's where my dauntless fame begins and ends. I clear my throat. One of you had to get knocked out, you know. If it hadn't been him, it would have been you.
Still, I don't want to do it again. Al shakes his head too many times too fast. He sniffs. I really don't. We reach the door to the training room and I say, But you have to. He has a kind face. Maybe he is too kind for Dauntless. I look at the chalkboard when I walk in. I didn't have to fight yesterday, but today I definitely will. When I see my name, I stop in the middle of the step. My opponent is Peter.
Oh, no, says Christina, who shuffles in behind us. Her face is bruised, and she looks like she is trying not to limp. When she sees the board, she crumples the muffin wrapper she is holding into her fist.
Are they serious? They're really going to make you fight him?
Peter is almost a foot taller than I am, and yesterday he beat Drew in less than 5 minutes. Today Drew's face is more black and blue than flesh-toned.
Maybe you can just take a few hits and pretend to go unconscious, suggests Al. No one would blame you.
Yeah, I say. Maybe. I stare at my name on the board. My cheeks feel hot.
Al and Christina are just trying to help, but the fact that they don't believe, not even in a tiny corner of their minds, that I have a chance against Peter bothers me.
I stand at the side of the room, half listening to Al and Christina's chatter, and watch Molly fight Edward. He's much faster than she is, so I'm sure Molly will not win today. As the fight goes on and my irritation fades, I start to get nervous. Four told us yesterday to exploit our opponent's weaknesses. And aside from his utter lack of likable qualities, Peter doesn't have any. He's tall enough to be strong, but not so big that he's slow. He has an eye for other people's soft spots. He's vicious and won't show me any mercy. I would like to say that he underestimates me, but that would be a lie. I am as unskilled as he suspects. Maybe Al is right, and I should just take a few hits and pretend to be unconscious. But I can't afford not to try. I can't be ranked last. By the time Molly peels herself off the ground, looking only half-conscious thanks to Edward, my heart is pounding so hard I can feel it in my fingertips. I can't remember how to stand. I can't remember how to punch. I walk to the center of the arena, and my guts writhe as Peter comes toward me. Taller than I remembered, arm muscles standing at attention. He smiles at me. I wonder if throwing up on him will do me any good. I doubt it.
You okay there, stiff? He says. You look like you're about to cry.
I might go easy on you if you cry. Over Peter's shoulder, I see Four standing by the door with his arms folded. His mouth is puckered, like he just swallowed something sour. Next to him is Eric, who taps his foot faster than my heartbeat. 1 second Peter and I are standing there, staring at each other, and the next Peter's hands are up by his face, his elbows bent. His knees are bent, too, like he's ready to spring.
Come on, stiff, he says, his eyes glinting. Just one little tear. Maybe some begging.
The thought of begging Peter for mercy makes me taste bile, and on an impulse, I kick him in the side. Or I would have kicked him in the side if he hadn't caught my foot and yanked it forward, knocking me off balance. My back smacks into the floor, and I pull my foot free, scrambling to my feet. I have to stay on my feet so he can't kick me in the head. That's the only thing I can think about.
Stop playing with her, snaps Eric. I don't have all day.
Peter's mischievous look disappears. His arm twitches, and pain stabs my jaw and spreads across my face, making my vision go black at the edges and my ears ring. I blink and lurch to the side as the room dips and sways. I don't remember his fist coming at me. I am too off balance to do anything but move away from him, as far as the arena will allow. He darts in front of me and kicks me hard in the stomach. His foot forces the air from my lungs and it hurts. Hurts so badly I can't breathe. Or maybe that's because of the kick. I don't know. I just fall.
On your feet, is the only thought in my mind. I push myself up, but Peter is already there. He grabs my hair with one hand and punches me in the nose with the other. This pain is different. Less like a stab and more like a crackle. Crackling in my brain, spotting my vision with different colors, blue, green, red. I try to shove him off, my hands slapping at his arms, and he punches me again. This time in the ribs. My face is wet. Bloody nose. More red, I guess. But I'm too dizzy to look down.
He shoves me and I fall again, scraping my hands on the ground, blinking, sluggish and slow and hot. I cough and drag myself to my feet. I really should be lying down if the room is spinning this fast. And Peter spins around me. I am the center of a spinning planet, the only thing staying still. Something hits me from the side, and I almost fall over again. On my feet, on my feet. I see a solid mass in front of me, a body. I punch as hard as I can, and my fist hits something soft. Peter barely groans, and smacks my ear with the flat of his palm, laughing under his breath. I hear ringing, and try to blink some of the black patches out of my eyes. How did something get in my eye? Out of my peripheral vision, I see Four shove the door open and walk out. Apparently this fight isn't interesting enough for him. Or maybe he's going to find out why everything's spinning like a top, and I don't blame him. I want to know the answer, too. My knees give out, and the floor is cool against my cheek. Something slams into my side, and I scream for the first time, a high screech that belongs to someone else, and not me. And it slams into my side again, and I can't see anything at all. Not even whatever is right in front of my face. The light's out. Someone shouts, "Enough!" And I think, too much, and nothing at all. When I wake up, I don't feel much, but the inside of my head is fuzzy, like it's packed with cotton balls. I know that I lost, and the only thing keeping the pain at bay is what is making it difficult to think straight. "Is her eye already black?" someone asks. I open one eye. The other stays shut like it's glued that way. Sitting to my right are Will and Al. Christina sits on the bed to my left with an ice pack on her jaw.
"What happened to your face?"
I say. My lips feel clumsy and too large. She laughs. "Look who's talking. Should we get you an eye patch?"
"Well, I already know what happened to my face," I say. "I was there. Sort of."
"Did you just make a joke, Tris?" Will says, grinning. "We should get you on painkillers more often if you're going to start cracking jokes. Oh, and to answer your question, I beat her up." "I can't believe you couldn't beat Will," Al says, shaking his head.
"What? He's good," she says, shrugging. "Plus, I think I finally learned how to stop losing. I just need to stop people from punching me in the jaw."
"You know, you'd think you would have figured that out already." Will winks at her. "Now I know why you aren't erudite. Not too bright, are you?"
"You feeling okay, Tris?" Al says. His eyes are dark brown, almost the same color as Christina's skin. His cheek looks rough. Like if he didn't shave it, he would have a thick beard. Hard to believe he's only 16.
"Yeah," I say. "Just wish I could stay here forever so I never have to see Peter again."
But I don't know where here is. I am in a large, narrow room, with a row of beds on either side. Some of the beds have curtains between them. On the right side of the room is a nurse's station. This must be where the Dauntless go when they're sick or hurt. The woman there looks at us over a clipboard. I've never seen a nurse with so many piercings in her ear before. Some Dauntless must volunteer to do jobs that traditionally belong to other factions. After all, it wouldn't make sense for the Dauntless to make the trek to the city hospital every time they get hurt. The first time I went to the hospital, I was 6 years old. My mother fell on the sidewalk in front of our house and broke her arm. Hearing her scream made me burst into tears, but Caleb just ran for my father, without saying a word. At the hospital, an Amity woman in a yellow shirt with clean fingernails took my mother's blood pressure and set her bone with a smile. I remember Caleb telling her that it would only take a month to mend, because it was a hairline fracture. I thought he was reassuring her, because that's what selfless people do. But now I wonder if he was repeating something he had studied. If all his abnegation tendencies were just erudite traits in disguise.
"Don't worry about Peter," says Will. "He'll at least get beat up by Edward, who has been studying hand-to-hand combat since we were 10 years old, for fun."
"Good," says Christina. She checks her watch. "I think we're missing dinner. Do you want us to stay here, Tris?" I shake my head.
I'm fine.
Christina and Will get up, but Al waves them ahead. He has a distinct smell, sweet and fresh, like sage and lemongrass. When he tosses and turns at night, I get a whiff of it, and I know he's having a nightmare.
I just wanted to tell you that you missed Eric's announcement. We're going on a field trip tomorrow, to the fence, to learn about dauntless jobs, he says. We have to be at the train by 8:15.
Good, I say. Thanks.
And don't pay attention to Christina. Your face doesn't look that bad.
He smiles a little.
I mean, it looks good. It always looks good.
I mean, you look brave. Dauntless.
His eyes skirt mine, and he scratches the back of his head. The silence seems to grow between us. It was a nice thing to say, but he acts like it meant more than just the words. I hope I am wrong. I could not be attracted to Al. I could not be attracted to anyone that fragile.
I smile as much as my bruised cheek will allow, hoping that will diffuse the tension.
I should let you rest, he says. He gets up to leave, but before he can go, I grab his wrist.
Al, are you okay?
I say. He stares blankly at me and I add,
I mean, is it getting any easier?
He shrugs.
A little.
He pulls his hand free and shoves it in his pocket. The question must have embarrassed him, because I've never seen him so red before. If I spent my night sobbing into my pillow, I would be a little embarrassed too. At least when I cry, I know how to hide it.
I lost to Drew, after your fight with Peter. He looks at me. I took a few hits, fell down, and stayed there, even though I didn't have to. I figure that since I beat Will, if I lose all the rest, I won't be ranked last. But I won't have to hurt anyone anymore.
Is that really what you want?
He looks down.
I just can't do it. Maybe that means I'm a coward.
You're not a coward just because you don't want to hurt people, I say. Because I know it's the right thing to say. Even if I'm not sure I mean it.
For a moment, we are both still, looking at each other.
Maybe I do mean it.
If he is a coward, it isn't because he doesn't enjoy pain. It is because he refuses to act. He gives me a pained look and says,
You think our families will visit us? They say transfer families never come on visiting day.
I don't know, I say. I don't know if it would be good or bad if they did.
I think bad. He nods.
Yeah.
It's already hard enough.
He nods again, as if confirming what he just said, and walks away. In less than a week, the abnegation initiates will be able to visit their families for the first time since the choosing ceremony. They will go home and sit in their living rooms and interact with their parents for the first time as adults. I used to look forward to that day. I used to think about what I would say to my mother and father when I was allowed to ask them questions at the dinner table. In less than a week, the Dauntless-born initiates will find their families on the pit floor, or in the glass building above the compound, and do whatever it is the Dauntless do when they reunite. Maybe they take turns throwing knives at each other's heads. It wouldn't surprise me.
And the transfer initiates with forgiving parents will be able to see them again, too.
I suspect mine will not be among them. Not after my father's cry of outrage at the ceremony. Not after both their children left them.
Maybe if I could have told them I was divergent, and I was confused about what to choose, they would have understood. Maybe they would have helped me figure out what divergent is, and what it means, and why it's dangerous. But I didn't trust them with that secret. So I will never know. I clench my teeth as the tears come. I'm fed up. I'm fed up with tears and weakness. But there isn't much I can do to stop them. Maybe I drift off to sleep, and maybe I don't. Later that night, though, I slip out of the room and go back to the dormitory. The only thing worse than letting Peter put me in the hospital would be letting him put me there overnight. Chapter 11. The next morning, I don't hear the alarm, shuffling feet or conversations as the other initiates get ready. I wake to Christina shaking my shoulder with one hand and tapping my cheek with the other. She already wears a black jacket zipped up to her throat. If she has bruises from yesterday's fight, her dark skin makes them difficult to see. "Come on," she says. "Up and at 'em." I dreamt that Peter tied me to a chair and asked me if I was divergent. I answered no, and he punched me until I said yes. I woke up with wet cheeks. I mean to say something, but all I can do is groan. My body aches so badly it hurts to breathe. It doesn't help that last night's bout of crying made my eyes swell. Christina offers me her hand. The clock reads 8. We're supposed to be at the tracks by 8:15. "I'll run and get us some breakfast. You just get ready. Looks like it might take you a while," she says. I grunt, trying not to bend at the waist. I fumble in the drawer, under my bed, for a clean shirt. Luckily, Peter isn't here to see me struggle. Once Christina leaves, the dormitory is empty. I unbutton my shirt and stare at my bare side, which is patched with bruises. For a second, the colors mesmerize me. Bright green and deep blue and brown. I change as fast as I can, and let my hair hang loose, because I can't lift my arms to tie it back. I look at my reflection in the small mirror on the back wall and see a stranger. She is blonde like me, with a narrow face like mine, but that's where the similarities stop. I do not have a black eye, and a split lip and a bruised jaw. I am not as pale as a sheet. She can't possibly be me, though she moves when I move. By the time Christina comes back, a muffin in each hand, I'm sitting on the edge of my bed staring at my untied shoes. I will have to bend over to tie them. It will hurt when I bend over. But Christina just passes me a muffin and crouches in front of me to tie my shoes. Gratitude surges in my chest, warm and a little like an ache. Maybe there is some abnegation in everyone, even if they don't know it. Well, and everyone but Peter. "Thank you," I say. "Well, we would never get there on time if you had to tie them yourself," she says. "Come on. You can eat and walk at the same time, right?" We walk fast toward the pit. The muffin is banana-flavored, with walnuts. My mother baked bread like this once, to give to the factionless, but I never got to try it. I was too old for coddling at that point. I ignore the pinch in my stomach that comes every time I think of my mother, and half walk, half jog after Christina, who forgets that her legs are longer than mine. We climb the steps from the pit to the glass building above it and run to the exit. Every thump of my feet sends pain through my ribs, but I ignore it. We make it to the tracks just as the train arrives, its horn blaring. "What took you so long?" Will shouts over the horn. "Stumpy legs over here turned into an old lady overnight," says Christina. "Oh, shut up." I'm only half kidding. Four stands at the front of the pack, so close to the tracks that if he shifted even an inch forward, the train would take his nose with it. He steps back to let some of the others get on first. Will hoists himself into the car with some difficulty, landing first on his stomach and then dragging his legs in behind him. Four grabs the handle on the side of the car and pulls himself in smoothly, like he doesn't have more than 6 feet of body to work with. I jog next to the car, wincing, then grit my teeth and grab the handle on the side. This is going to hurt. Al grabs me under each arm and lifts me easily into the car. Pain shoots through my side, but it only lasts for a second. I see Peter behind him, and my cheeks get warm. Al was trying to be nice, so I smile at him. But I wish people didn't want to be so nice, as if Peter didn't have enough ammunition already. "Feeling okay there?" Peter says, giving me a look of mock sympathy. His lips turned down, his arched eyebrows pulled in. "Or are you a little stiff?" He bursts into laughter at his joke, and Molly and Drew join in. Molly has an ugly laugh, all snorting and shaking shoulders, and Drew's is silent, so it almost looks like he's in pain. "We are all awed by your incredible wit," says Will.
"Yeah, are you sure you don't belong with the erudite, Peter?" Christina adds.
I hear they don't object to sissies.
Four, standing in the doorway, speaks before Peter can retort. Am I going to have to listen to your bickering all the way to the fence?
Everyone gets quiet, and Four turns back to the car's opening. He holds the handles on either side, his arms stretching wide, and leans forward so his body is mostly outside the car, though his feet stay planted inside. The wind presses his shirt to his chest. I try to look past him at what we're passing, a sea of crumbling, abandoned buildings that get smaller as we go. Every few seconds, though, my eyes shift back to Four. I don't know what I expect to see, or what I want to see, if anything. But I do it without thinking. I ask Christina, what do you think is out there?
I nod to the doorway.
I mean, beyond the fence.
She shrugs.
A bunch of farms, I guess?
Yeah, but I mean, past the farms. What are we guarding the city from?
She wiggles her fingers at me.
Monsters.
I roll my eyes.
We didn't even have guards near the fence until 5 years ago, says Will. Don't you remember when Dauntless Police used to patrol the factionless sector?
Yes, I say. I also remember that my father was one of the people who voted to get the Dauntless out of the factionless sector of the city. He said the poor didn't need policing. They needed help, and we could give it to them. But I would rather not mention that now, or here. It's one of the many things Erudite gives as evidence of abnegation's incompetence.
Oh, right, he says.
I bet you saw them all the time.
Why do you say that? I ask, a little too sharply. I don't want to be associated too closely with the factionless.
Because you had to pass the factionless sector to get to school, right?
What did you do, memorize a map of the city for fun? Says Christina.
Yes, says Will, looking puzzled.
Didn't you?
The train's brakes squeal, and we all lurch forward as the car slows. I am grateful for the movement. It makes standing easier. The dilapidated buildings are gone, replaced by yellow fields and train tracks. The train stops under an awning. I lower myself to the grass, holding the handle to keep me steady. In front of me is a chain-link fence with barbed wire strung along the top. When I walk forward, I notice that it continues farther than I can see, perpendicular to the horizon. Past the fence is a cluster of trees, most of them dead, some green. Milling around on the other side of the fence are dauntless guards, carrying guns.
Follow me, says Four. I stay close to Christina. I don't want to admit it, not even to myself, but I feel calmer when I'm near her. If Peter tries to taunt me, she will defend me. Silently, I scold myself for being such a coward. Peter's insults shouldn't bother me, and I should focus on getting better at combat, not on how badly I did yesterday. And I should be willing, if not able, to defend myself instead of relying on other people to do it for me.
Four leads us toward the gate, which is as wide as a house, and opens up to the cracked road that leads to the city. When I came here with my family as a child, we rode in a bus on that road and beyond to Amity's Farms, where we spent the day picking tomatoes and sweating through our shirts. Another pinch in my stomach.
If you don't rank in the top five at the end of initiation, you will probably end up here, says Four as he reaches the gate. Once you are a fence guard, there is some potential for advancement, but not much. You may be able to go on patrols beyond Amity's Farms, but...
Patrols for what purpose? Asks Will.
Four lifts a shoulder.
I suppose you'll discover that if you find yourself among them.
As I was saying, for the most part, those who guard the fence when they are young continue to guard the fence. If it comforts you, some of them insist that it isn't as bad as it seems.
Yeah. At least we won't be driving buses or cleaning up other people's messes like the factionless, Christina whispers in my ear.
What rank were you?
Peter asks Four.
I don't expect Four to answer, but he looks levelly at Peter and says,
I was first.
And you chose to do this?
Peter's eyes are wide and round and dark green. They would look innocent to me if I didn't know what a terrible person he is.
Why didn't you get a government job?
I didn't want one, Four says flatly. I remember what he said on the first day, about working in the control room, where the Dauntless monitor the city's security. It is difficult for me to imagine him there, surrounded by computers. To me, he belongs in the training room.
We learned about faction jobs in school. The Dauntless have limited options. We can guard the fence or work for the security of our city. We can work in the Dauntless compound, drawing tattoos or making weapons, or even fighting each other for entertainment. Or we can work for the Dauntless leaders. That sounds like my best option. The only problem is that my rank is terrible, and I might be factionless by the end of stage one.
We stop next to the gate. A few Dauntless guards glance in our direction, but not many. They are too busy pulling the doors, which are twice as tall as they are and several times wider, open to admit a truck. The man driving wears a hat, a beard, and a smile. He stops just inside the gate and gets out. The back of the truck is open, and a few other Amities sit among the stacks of crates. I peer at the crates. They hold apples.
Beatrice? An Amity boy says.
My head jerks at the sound of my name. One of the Amity in the back of the truck stands. He has curly blonde hair and a familiar nose, wide at the tip and narrow at the bridge. Robert. I try to remember him at the choosing ceremony, and nothing comes to mind but the sound of my heart in my ears. Who else transferred? Did Susan? Are there any abnegation initiates this year? If abnegation is fizzling, it's our fault. Robert's and Caleb's and mine.
Mine.
I push the thought from my mind. Robert hops down from the truck. He wears a gray t-shirt and a pair of blue jeans. After a second's hesitation, he moves toward me and folds me in his arms. I stiffen. Only in Amity do people hug each other in greeting. I don't move a muscle until he releases me. His own smile fades when he looks at me again.
Beatrice, what happened to you? What happened to your face?
Nothing, I say. Just training. Nothing.
Beatrice, demands a nasal voice next to me. Molly folds her arms and laughs. Is that your real name, Stiff?
I glance at her.
What do you think Triss was short for?
Oh, I don't know. Weakling.
She touches her chin. If her chin was bigger, it might balance out her nose, but it is weak and almost recedes into her neck.
Oh, wait. That doesn't start with Triss. My mistake.
There's no need to antagonize her, Robert says softly. I'm Robert, and you are...
Someone who doesn't care what your name is, she says. Why don't you get back in your truck? We're not supposed to fraternize with other faction members.
Why don't you get away from us?
I snap.
Right. Wouldn't want to get between you and your boyfriend, she says.
She walks away smiling. Robert gives me a sad look.
They don't seem like nice people.
Some of them aren't.
You could go home, you know. I'm sure abnegation would make an exception for you.
What makes you think I want to go home? I ask, my cheeks hot.
You think I can't handle this or something?
It's not that, he shakes his head. It's not that you can't. It's that you shouldn't have to. You should be happy.
This is what I chose. This is it.
I look over Robert's shoulder. The Dauntless guards seem to have finished examining the truck. The bearded man gets back into the driver's seat and closes the door behind him. Besides, Robert, the goal of my life isn't just to be happy.
Wouldn't it be easier if it was, though? He says.
Before I can answer, he touches my shoulder and turns toward the truck. A girl in the back has a banjo on her lap. She starts to strum it as Robert hoists himself inside, and the truck starts forward, carrying the banjo sounds and her warbling voice away from us. Robert waves at me, and again, I see another possible life in my mind's eye. I see myself in the back of the truck, singing with the girl, though I've never sung before, laughing when I'm off-key, climbing trees to pick the apples, always peaceful and always safe. The Dauntless guards close the gate,
and lock it behind them. The lock is on the outside. I bite my lip. Why would they lock the gate from the outside and not the inside?